Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at EPLRoundtable@gmail.com.
Hi, Kev. Thanks very much for having me back on. Very good to be here. I'm Sam Karp. I'm a Crystal Palace supporter, and you can find me on Twitter at Sam_Karp.
Hi, guys. Good to be with you. I'm Steve McGugan. I'm a Spurs fan based in Belfast. And in a previous life, I was the chairman of the New York City Spurs Supporters Club.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining me today, guys. First off, I just want to apologize to the loyal listeners out there. It's been a while since we recorded a show. We had the international break, and then I was on vacation, came back and got sick. We're finally back here for the run-in. To talk about all things Premier League. I figure we'll start off with a moment of history today with Erling Haaland matching the Premier League record for goals in a single season. He's on 34. There's still, how many matches do they have left? They still have six matches to go. You'd imagine he's probably going to break it. Honestly, just incredible stuff from him in his debut season in the Premier League. Are you surprised that he was able to adapt to the Premier League so easily?
I don't know if I'm surprised. It's funny, actually, looking back to the start of the season, because people were talking about Haaland coming in at City and making comparisons with Nunes coming in at Liverpool. Essentially two teams that had kind of, I guess, been missing that focal point, that number nine. Despite that, had been putting up these incredible numbers, amazing title races year after year. And I suppose the sort of the argument was whichever of these two players performs better, that team is ultimately going to win the league. I remember watching the Community Shield at the start of the season. Liverpool won that game 3-1. I think Nunes scored late on and Haaland didn't have the best game. I remember quite a few clips going around on social media of essentially just when you've kind of got there's that music playing in the background and all the notes are off because of like every time Haaland does something wrong, and people are kind of quite quick to write him off, as is kind of the case when a player has a bad game and has arrived from a foreign competition into the Premier League. And then I think within a month of that, he'd scored two goals in his debut against West Ham, had bagged a hat-trick against Palace when they'd been 2-0 down at halftime, and, you know, was already like streets ahead in the race for the golden boot. So very, very quickly proved the doubt was wrong. But I don't think anyone will really be that surprised that he has done that. It was pretty clear from his brief time at Salzburg and then at Dortmund that he was this superhuman, generational, ultra confident talent who, wherever he goes, is going to score goals, let alone in a team like City. And I think also the fact that he'd scored goals in the Champions League before coming to England, you know, regularly doing it against top opposition, was proof enough in itself that he was going to be able to do it against, you know, not only top sides in the Premier League, but also, you know, the other sort of 14 teams that are in there. And I think also just like when you look at his attributes, like he's physically imposing, he's incredibly quick, which was always going to bode well in a league that's often talked about for its speed and its physicality. So those two things, set him up for success in the first place anyway. So I think he's already blessed with these unique, natural attributes before you even get into the talent of, you know, his finishing ability and that kind of sixth sense that he has to just know where the ball is going to drop in the box. Like, how many goals can you remember that he scored this season where the ball's kind of rolled to the back post and he's kind of just been stood there to tap it into an empty net? Like, I just always you know, people sort of say those are easy goals, but I just think there's an innate skill to be able to do that. And then, as I kind of alluded to before, the fact that he's just been parachuted into the best team in the league that has scored bundles of goals in the last few seasons without a striker, is just another reason that we shouldn't be surprised by this. You know, he's surrounded by the best creative talent in the league. He's managed by the best manager in the world. I don't want to undermine the achievement and say it's all been easy, because he deserves credit. He's only 22. There was so much expectation on him coming in, and we've seen so many players arrive in the Premier League with, you know, big transfer fees attached to their name, big expectations, and haven't quite delivered on it. And he's also missed some games this season because of injury as well, which makes it even more impressive that he's done this with six games still to go. It would just be interesting to see how many more he gets before the end of the season. But no, I'm not surprised that he's done it.
No, I totally agree with all of that. Absolutely not surprised. I mean, I think anyone who had watched him on TV play in any context, in any competition, I think was probably expecting something sensational. And, you know, this season really has been phenomenal for him. I mean, to get the league record, and also the record across all competitions as well, you know, the 50 goals is, and that has stood for, what, nearly a century, apparently. So just an amazing achievement. And also, when you think about it, as Sam mentioned, you know, you're dropping him into probably the best team, or the best squad that the Premier League can offer, with the best manager. And also, you know, City now have both Haaland and Julian Alvarez, and you know, that's kind of like, that will turn out over time, that'll turn out to be like having Shearer and Andy Cole in the same team, or in a baseball context, like having Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani, except your team actually wins something. But I mean, just according to an Optostat I saw earlier, I mean, Haaland has scored in 67% of his starts across all competitions, and the second highest percentage is Alvarez at 61%. So, you know, when you've got those two guys who are firing the way they are, it's inevitable that one of them is going to turn out to be the sort of player that we saw Haaland be this season. And Alvarez scored a fantastic goal against Fulham today as well. So, I mean, talking of City, just for a second, I mean, I think it's interesting that Haaland's understanding with Grealish looks to have been improving recently. And you remember all the talk at the time about the potential Harry Kane transfer, how, you know, City should have bought Harry instead of Grealish. Well, you know, that looks out like it's turned out okay for them. And we'll come on to talk about Harry Kane in another context as well. But I think the interesting thing also is that Haaland grew up a Leeds fan, and what they wouldn't give for even a small percentage of his goal tally for this season. I think that would work for them. But there we go.
Yeah, I don't mind holding my hands up here. At the start of the season, I said I thought he'd score 15 or 16 goals. So just about wrong by double on my end. I think some of my concerns, and you touched on it a little bit at the start there, Sam, was coming into the season, Manchester City moving to using a kind of a focal point number nine after winning the league 2 years in a row, if memory serves, playing like more with a false nine, which Jesus then went to Arsenal and then obviously had the year he had before he got injured. But yeah, it was just like, it'll take them time to adjust the tactics to fit him into it. He might, you know, face a little bit more difficulty in the Premier League than he had previously. But just know, it turned up being very incorrect. Harry Kane right now, by the by, on 25 goals, would have beaten last year's Golden Boot total, which was 23, shared by Salah and Son. And he's going to finish like 10 behind Haaland. Like, I know. Just to put it into context, how insane the season Haaland is having. But yeah, just absolutely incredible stuff. I do still think there was some merit to thinking that it wouldn't go this well. I don't know what percentile chance it was that he'd go off for 34 or even more and break the record his first year. But regardless, he's hit it. Yeah, all credit to him and credit to City for now sitting in first with a game in hand. We'll obviously see how the Premier League title race winds up, but you will not hear us discussing bottling on this particular show.
Sorry, Kev, just because you did ask when the record, when you think the record might be broken.
Yeah.
I think actually, given the way that City are likely to be playing in multiple competitions for the foreseeable future, it's hard really to see anyone except Haaland breaking the record at anytime soon.
Yeah, I was going to say probably next year, no? But there's no reason that the city side isn't going to get any weaker, and he's only going to get better with a season in the Premier League under his belt. So if he stays fit, I can see him breaking it again next season.
Okay, well, assuming that, and I agree with you guys, assuming he's the person that breaks his own record, when will somebody not named Erling Haaland break whatever record he ends up setting?
Years and years from now, I think. He's getting into that territory where we used to see with, Messi and Ronaldo for all those years, in terms of they'd just be so far out in front of anyone else in Europe in terms of the numbers they were putting up year after year. Again, I've used the word generational before, and I think that's what Haaland is at the moment. It's not Ronaldo and Messi anymore. It's going to be him and Mbappe are the ones putting up those numbers on a regular basis. I feel like it would be after Haaland retires, I think, by the next time we see someone do this sort of thing. I think that's how I'd put on it.
Unless he moves to Leeds.
Well, yeah.
And then he'll break the championship record.
Very good.
Cool. All right. We'll move on from there to talk about some of the clubs that we'll be seeing not too far from now. In the last week or so, Burnley won the championship title and Sheffield United earned themselves automatic promotion, although it seems like there's some financial issues going on there with them potentially not able to even pay the promotion payments. You'd imagine that the Premier League money will help that. Maybe it's more of a timing issue. But not too long since we've seen either of these teams in the Premier League. Are you excited to see them rejoining?
Excited probably isn't the right word. You always want new teams. As a fan who goes to games, you want new grounds to go and visit. And Burnley and Sheffield United have been regulars in the Premier League over the last couple of decades, I suppose you'd say. So I don't know if it's that exciting, the sort of identity of the two teams getting automatic promoted is that exciting. Although we might get a bit of a wild card from the playoffs with teams like Luton in there, which I think would be really interesting to see them in the Premier League. But you have got to give both Burnley and Sheffield United credit, obviously. Burnley have had an unbelievable season. I don't think they're quite going to break the record for the number of points, but they've gone pretty close. And also, just in terms of completely revamping their style of play under Vincent Kompany, the way they've done it has been incredibly impressive, overhauling the squad a fair bit as well, especially because when you think about when they went down last season, there was quite a lot of uncertainty about the ownership. Sean Dyche obviously leaving after such a long time at the club. They've really sort of had to embrace this complete change of direction, and they've completely smashed it, really. So it's been a really, really impressive season from them. Sheffield United, again, just obviously haven't bounced back straight away after relegation, but it's impressive that they've managed to do it again. But I think it also speaks to the impact of the parachute payment system The impact that still has in that division. It shows that relegated clubs really do have a very good chance of getting promoted back to the Premier League within 3 years of going down. As I say, Burnley have been able to, while revamping their style, they bring in the players who have helped them do that. They've also been able to lean on Vincent Kompany's, reputation and sort of contacts and some of the loan players that they've been able to get in, which is helpful. But I think just in terms of going back to that sort of financial side of it, I've got a Burnley supporting friend who goes to most games home and away, and he's not really missed one in the last few weeks. He lives in London, but he's just been going to the home games, away games, But I think he's been fairly surprised just at how poor some of the teams down there are. And you just look at teams like Reading, Wigan, who I think got relegated, whose relegation was confirmed yesterday, and sort of the perilous financial state they're in. There's probably like a more existential conversation we could have really in terms of, you know, the impact of when these teams do get relegated from the Premier League and they do have these parachute payments to lean on and can still pay these, I guess, Premier League style wages for two or three seasons, the knock-on impact that has on the clubs below them trying to compete and spending beyond their means, it can have like a really, really damaging impact. And I think the Championship generally is in a bit of a mess at the moment. But yeah, without trying to be too negative, fair play to Burnley and Sheffield United.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a happy time for Alistair Campbell and Sean Bean, certainly. But it is always, as you say, Sam, I think it's always good to see well-followed teams play in the top flight. You know, traditional English football grounds filled to the doors with passionate fans. And in terms of whether these two teams and whoever the playoff winner turns out to be, and it would be great to see Luton go up, to be honest. Whether they're here for the long haul, I think like every year around about this time, it comes down to how they're able to strengthen their squad, you know, getting the right players in, particularly some that have Premiership experience who can improve the overall group is pretty crucial. I mean, like Forest last season, talking about, you know, traditional strongly followed teams, it was good to see them back after, especially after so long. But then I think we all thought, what on earth are they doing buying so many players? But now, you know, it looks like they have a chance to save themselves in the end, but we'll see. But that, you know, their minus 32 goal difference isn't a good sign. So, you know, it's possible, always possible with every new season that the newly promoted teams might end up just joining the annual relegation kind of merry-go-round. But then look at how well teams like Brighton and Brentford especially have done since they came up, contrasted with how inconsistent Everton and Leicester have been this season. Even West Ham, I suppose, to a certain extent, but they should probably be okay now. I think it probably is coming down to the wire with any two from 19th up to Leeds and 16th could probably go down with Southampton. And you mentioned earlier Bournemouth. Bournemouth have done a fantastic job of late, and it is just amazing what a little self-belief can do for a team, but there's still four or five games to go. So, you know, overall, the Premiership needs a mix of those traditional football powerhouses, and the unexpected upstart teams that you don't expect to get into the Premiership. And Sam mentioned the parachute payments. And I think the fundamental problem going forward will continue to be that wealth gap between the top and the bottom of the Premiership, and as well as ownership and the conduct, the conduct of the club and how it's organized. I think that largely comes down to the effect of the Champions League. You know, if the self-perpetuating riches that come from participating in the Champions League are so much greater than can be earned domestically, and that wealth continues to be shared among, you know, a very limited universe of teams, then it's hardly a surprise that the league stratifies very sharply between the top six or seven or even eight and, you know, the bottom 10. And that, you know, that's good from a competitive perspective, I suppose, in that, you know, every season there seem to be fewer teams that are left literally with nothing to play for going into the final few games. Broadcasters are happy. The neutral fans are happy. The only people not happy are fans of the team that get into a bad run and find themselves falling down the league. So yeah, it's I think that wealth issue is still one that's going to have to be addressed over the next few seasons. But as long as the Champions League keeps so much potential revenue in the hands of so few clubs, I can't see anything changing there.
I just want to touch on, I guess, the chances of Sheffield United and Burnley staying up, because Steve mentioned some I guess, about Forest in terms of how they approached last summer. And I think, like, if you look at what influenced that, they had so many players on loan during that promotion season, so they kind of had no choice but to dip into the market. And I think there's a few factors that often I kind of look at when teams come up, and like that sort of, that's one of them in terms of how many players they've got on loan and whether, you know, how important those players have been in those teams getting promoted. And you look at Burnley, I think two of their starting centre-backs have been on loan this season. Their left-back, Mattson, is on loan from Chelsea. Nathan Teller, who's scored about 20 goals, I think, is on loan from Southampton, who might want to keep hold of him, given that where they're going to be playing their football next season, and seeing the success that he's had down there. So that's already sort of four starters off the top of your head that they're going to need to potentially either, you know, negotiate another season for or replace. Sheffield United, it was sort of exposed in that FA Cup semi-final against City that two of their best players this season have been on loan from Manchester City. So that's already a kind of a disadvantage, is two sides. And then another thing you sort of look at is goal scorers. We spoke about Mitrovic before, I think, at Fulham, and Tony at Brentford. That's a big reason that those two sides stayed up in the past two seasons. You look at Burnley and Sheffield United, there's not really anyone, a standout player you can see sort of scoring 15 goals for them next year. So they'll have to go into the market in those positions in the same way that, you know, every team outside the top six is looking for a 15 goal a season striker, really, apart from, as I say, Brentford and Fulham. So that's another area that you'd be looking at. And then Steve alluded to the fact that there are some teams down there this season like West Ham, and I think it's kind of been a bit of a wake-up call for a few of those sides, the fact that, you know, Leicester, West Ham, I guess Everton being down there again, if they manage to stay up, it'll be a real wake-up call in the sense that they won't want to be down there again, essentially. So you can't see them sort of sitting on their hands this summer, so they'll probably look to strengthen, which is maybe one of the things that will work against Burnley and Sheffield United. But as Steve said, you know, I don't think many people would have predicted them to stay up this year. So, and there are some incredibly bad teams in the bottom half of the Premier League. So there's every chance, but there are definitely some challenges that we have to address over the summer.
I don't know how many wake-up calls Everton need, but yeah, maybe this will be the one that takes for them if they manage to stay up. A lot of great points made by you guys. I am really interested to see how Vincent Kompany's brand of football will play in the Premier League at a club like Burnley or at a club like Tottenham. I'm just really curious because, like, the last time we saw Burnley, as you guys were mentioning, it was Dyche-ball. It was really defensive. They got relegated. They had a lot of really old players that had been in the system for a long time, maybe kind of turned a bit of a deaf ear towards Dyche and some of his antics and stuff like that. But now they're like an entirely new squad, a new manager, a new play style. So I am really curious to see how that goes. And also the culture shock it gives people that haven't really been as aware of what's been rumbling down there in the championship at Burnley. But yeah, we'll see. Also, you guys mentioned some of the teams that are currently in that relegation fight. I think I'm personally pretty comfortable cutting Southampton. Are you guys there yet? And any other teams that you feel comfortable will be the ones that end up going down that'll get replaced by these two?
I don't think there's anyone other than Southampton that you could actually write off at this point. I think Southampton have just been unfortunate in terms of their inconsistency. I mean, they went ahead today, didn't they, against Bournemouth? Yeah, and they couldn't hold on to it. So, yeah, I think Southampton at this stage are the only team that really. I mean, there's still four or five games to go. So they're probably the only team that you would say are probably gone.
Yeah, I feel like everyone's been flirting with writing off Southampton all season, but not actually wanting to, just because of how close they still have been to. They still were within touching distance, essentially. Like, no one team has been sort of cut 10 points adrift, as often tends to happen. But looking at the table now, you know, they're 6 points off 17th with only four games to play. So there's nothing really to suggest that they're going to have what it takes to get out of it. But just that relegation battle in general, you know, we were talking before we came on the call, there were sort of nine teams involved in it, probably as recently as 3 weeks ago, maybe. And it's kind of started to separate itself out. But I think what's also What's also become apparent is just how bad some of those five sides are. Like I saw Leicester play at Selhurst Park not that long ago, Everton last weekend, the Southampton game as well. I mean, we've been privileged that we've managed to play some of those, the four of the teams in that bottom five in the past few weeks. And they've just been so, so poor. I mean, looking at the form table now, there's only two wins between those five teams in all of their last five fixtures, which tells you, and you know, just how badly they've been playing, and they're not sort of putting any sort of run together. And you think if just one or two wins for any of those teams in these last four games will be absolutely priceless. But it is really hard to call at the moment. I think Leeds look like they're in free fall, which is strange because it wasn't that long ago that you were looking at them and they were sort of, you know, the challenge for any team down there is scoring goals, and Leeds seem to be scoring fairly regularly, whether it's through Nonto, who'd been in really good form, Bamford coming back into the side. But ever since that sort of happened, it's flipped, and they, you know, they can't seem to score as many, and they just can't seem to stop letting them in at the other end either. So you do wonder whether Leeds are going to drop in. Forest seem to be showing a little bit more fight. I know they conceded those two goals against Brentford's yesterday, but obviously the game against Brighton was a really big win, and then they came close to getting something at Anfield, so you feel as if, you know, maybe something is brewing there. But Leicester, you just feel that squad, it's dangerous saying too good to go down, but you can't, like, getting relegated with a squad that has James Maddison, Harvey Barnes, Yuri Tielemans in it would just be absolutely criminal. And then at Everton, another one that you don't hold out much hope for them, but you wonder if they might just end up scraping out. And I can almost see the bottom three ending up being Southampton, Forest and Leeds. But yeah, see, I think there's a lot of surprises left, and it'll be pretty exciting to watch as a neutral, but pretty grim for those five teams involved.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be an interesting time here down the stretch. Because, you know, it seems like the top four is just going to be the top four now. But City versus Arsenal still, obviously, I think, for the title in that relegation race is going to be truly something. I'm, you know, there are not many things I'd rather not be than a Spurs fan right now. But if I was in that relegation fight, it would probably be a pretty nerve-wracking time. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll be back with club-specific questions for each of our guests.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, and we are back. Sam, we were talking about it a little bit before we hit record. But Roy Hodgson hasn't seemingly done a whole lot to get you firing, but all of a sudden you've scored multiple goals in four of your last five matches. You've won three of them, only lost one, set yourselves up at 40 points, which surely is enough to be safe this season, especially with all the teams we were just talking about still in the middle of that relegation race. If it hasn't been like a big tactical shift or anything from Hodgson, what do you think brought about this very like night and day shift at Palace over the last month or so?
Yeah, it's been pretty wild, to be honest. I'm not sure anyone could have expected it. And Hodgson actually walked, there's a clip going around of him walking into his post-match press conference yesterday, and he says, before any of you ask, yes, I think we're safe. So if Hodgson thinks it, I'm happy to think it as well. So I think we can start planning for life again in the Premier League next season. But yeah, as you say, it's funny. The thing is, he hasn't done all that much differently. And I think there was a lot of apprehension when he came in, just based on what happened at Watford last year and how his time at Palace came to an end. You know, things felt like they'd gone a little bit stale. And then obviously at Watford, I think this, looking back on that, you know, the squad he inherited at Watford was nowhere near as good as the one that he's inherited here. And they were on a bit of a downward spiral anyway, so perhaps it wasn't quite the right fit. But yeah, I think there, weirdly, I think there are some parallels to the situation that he inherited when Frank de Boer left the club and he took over from him. I'm not trying to sort of say that Vieira was anywhere near as bad as Frank de Boer was, but there were sort of some similar issues at the end of his tenure in terms of trying to play a system that didn't necessarily suit the players that he had, also trying to shoehorn players into positions which they weren't particularly comfortable playing. So De Boer, for example, used to play like Luka Milivojevic at right back. And we sort of had the, it wasn't quite as dramatic this time, but Vieira was pretty stubborn in picking the same 11. He'd have players like Jeffrey Schlupp playing as a CDM, which just, you know, it's not the best approach really. And so I think all that Hodgson has done, as he did when he took over from De Boer all those years ago, is he's had a look at the squad, realised it's a pretty good squad, and just put the best players on the pitch in their best positions and just told them to go and play and kind of given them a little pat on the back, told them how good they are, and they just seem to be responding to it. I think there's no player that sort of has borne out in more than Eze, who's just kind of been, he's kind of been the face of this revival, I guess, because obviously you typically associate a Palace recovery with Wilfred Zaha going on a run of form, but he's actually been out injured since the first half of Hodgson's first game back. So Eze, who just couldn't get in the team under Vieira, has suddenly become kind of, you know, the focal point of everything good that's happening. He's been scoring pretty freely. He just seems to have so much more energy as well. So I don't know what quite was going on there with him and Vieira, but the fact that, you know, the fact that Vieira wasn't picking Eze just seems like an increasingly odd, odd decision given just the talent of the kids, how exciting he is to watch, and there is just a sense that everyone's playing with a little bit more freedom now than they were under Vieira, which, based on what we saw last season and kind of in terms of the high intensity pressing football that came to be associated with Vieira's first season in charge, like, not, I don't think anyone would have expected, you know, the manager he replaced to come back in and then reinvigorate that style of play this season. But that's what's happened, and it's been really, really fun to watch. And I don't think even the most optimistic of Palace fan would have imagined that we'd be safe with four games to go when Hodgson took over. I think a lot of us were expecting it to go down to the wire. So yeah, I think everyone's pretty grateful for the job that he's done, and a lot of people will be going back through their Twitter and deleting some of the reactions that they had when he first got appointed.
Yeah, kind of related to some of what you were saying about thinking it was going to be touch and go to the wire. I think you went winless in 12 consecutive matches, and then now you have 4 wins in the last 6. that's the kind of turnaround for people that haven't been watching them closely that's gone on lately. You mentioned Roy saying you're safe, so I won't ask you if you think you're safe. So as you say, let's kind of look forward. Is there any chance that Roy's like, well, this manager Malark's pretty easy, maybe I'll just stay on? Or do you have a sense of the direction the club want to go after this season?
Who knows? I think it would feel quite weird if Hodgson were to get it. It very much has felt like he's been, you know, Steve Parish has gone, right, we're in a bit of trouble here. Who's and looked at essentially the struggles that teams in our position have had in appointing a manager on such a short-term basis. So he was pretty fortunate in the sense that he had that existing relationship with Hodgson. And like we've seen with managers like Gracia, you know, Leicester appointing Dean Smith, it's been really, really hard for some of the teams around us to bring in a top level manager in the same way that maybe Villa were able to when they were struggling at the start of the season. So I think personally that it's better for him to leave at the end of the season on a high. He's often alluded to the fact that he didn't get to leave the club in the way that he would have liked. You know, his last game managing us was in front of a limited capacity crowd because of COVID restrictions, and he didn't quite get the farewell that he probably deserved. So I feel like there's no better way really for him to go out than kind of having kept us up, hopefully add a few more points to that tally before the end of the season, rather than risk having too much of a good thing and then things kind of going sour in October, for example, and just having to have an awkward conversation then. And I think the ambitions of the club is probably to go back into the market, have a look at who's available, because there are quite a lot of good managers available now. You think of Rodgers, Potter, who will probably end up at maybe slightly bigger clubs than Palace. But we've been linked with a few names abroad. I feel the club wants to go in that direction. They've seen what sort of happened with that first season under Vieira, which gave us all a taste of, you know, what it can be like. But I think the crucial thing will just be kind of continuing to recruit in the way that we have done in the past few seasons. And, you know, I think Vieira's season was so good last season, partially because we, you know, added really, really good centre backs in Gay and Anderson, bought in Elise. And so if we can just kind of strengthen as well as getting the managerial appointment right, I think that should stand us in good stead for next season. And it'll be important to make that appointment early, because historically we've never been particularly good at acting decisively when appointing a new manager. I think Vieira was appointed only about a month before the season started, and we'd missed out on one or two of our top targets. I think back to when De Boer again was appointed, that was sort of like a summer saga that went on for quite a while. So hopefully the board is looking at it now, looking at who's available, looking at who would be interested in the job. And I think anyone looking at it now, as opposed to, you know, when Vieira left, there was sort of, we were a bit of a laughing stock really, and you wouldn't have blamed any manager for sort of looking at that situation and thinking, well, I'm not going to be able to, if Vieira wasn't given the time to turn that around, then I don't really want to go into a club like that. But I think having watched the way we've played in the last five games, looking at some of the talent that we have, I think it's probably become an increasingly attractive job for someone out there. So I think there'll be candidates. I'm sure Parrish is probably, there's part of him that thinks maybe we give it to Roy for another season, but he's a 75-year-old man. I'm sure he's got more relaxing ways of spending his Saturdays. And I think it would be in everyone's interest really if we sort of had a very nice farewell in the sunshine on that last game against Forest and went our separate ways.
That makes sense. Well, a great transition you've given us there of talking about a laughingstock who might be playing so poorly that it could talk a manager out of potentially joining. Steve, let's talk about Tottenham Hotspur. Today's match was just wild, a 4-3 against Liverpool, although our matches against them are always just bananas. Come all the way back from 3-0, equalize 3-3, concede 30 seconds later to lose 4-3. In just the micro context, just of today, were you more disappointed with the start yet again and result? Or were you somewhat pleased to at least see signs of life there in the second half?
No. Two things, Kevin. I think I was resigned to how we started today. But I think also you have to see it in the context of this week, this week's games, the run of games. I mean, this was always going to be a crucial week for us. I mean, even with the expectation that we might have actually won the games leading up to it. But you know, we had to go to Newcastle, we had to play Man U, and then we ended up at Liverpool. And I'll come back to the other two in a second, but I was saying before we came on the air, it's like I texted my friend when Richarlison equalized, and I just said, you couldn't script this. But then 30 seconds later, I texted him back saying, well, of course you could. Of course you could. Today was absolutely the worst example of Spursy, because even though you knew what was coming, it was still a surprise when it did. And it's the hope that kills you, Kev. And if you haven't learned this by now, then I haven't done a good enough job in teaching you. You know, we've conceded 17 Premier League goals in April. That's the most we've ever conceded in a calendar month in the Premier League. And once again, you know, we don't start playing until we go behind. It's a familiar pattern. This rope-a-dope play on the break doesn't work if you're not controlling the ball. And I thought, you know, Chris Waddle said on the BBC commentary today, you don't wait to see what happens. You make things happen. And you never get a sense with Spurs at the moment that we're trying to do that for most of the game. I mean, that you watched it. The first half was a complete shambles. Our confidence is shot to hell. The players should be embarrassed, but I think they're incapable of being embarrassed, Kev, or it doesn't matter. I mean, they can refund the fans who go to every away game, but that won't make any difference. We seem to go into every game now as if nothing is at stake. At halftime today, it looked like the second half of how we played in the second half against Man United during the week. It looked like that was a blip, that we'd learned nothing from it and that we weren't bothered about building on it. And I want to go back and I want to talk also about the context of the Newcastle game and then quickly the Manchester United game before finishing up with where this leaves us. Because I think like a lot of Spurs fans, it took me a couple of days to think rationally about the performance at Newcastle. And you know, all those emergency alert jokes that were going around at the time, I mean, they were just too on the nose at the time that was happening on a day when we were being given a complete and utter football lesson at that stage. And you have to say, I mean, you know, well done to Newcastle, who are having a remarkable spell at the moment. As bereft as we were in that game, they were actually brilliant. They were well organized. They were motivated. They knew what was at stake. I mentioned earlier that we go into games now as if there's nothing at stake. There's nothing to play for. And you know, before that game, even a blind man could have seen the sort of game that we were walking into. And it was almost immediately obvious that we hadn't shown up. I find myself agreeing a couple of days later with what a lot of Jack Pitbrook wrote in The Athletic, where he said that Spurs have been in an inevitable downward trajectory since we lost the Champions League final in 2019. I actually think it probably goes back a couple of seasons before that, but I see where he's coming from. But what he stopped short of saying, because he was sharing out the blame for our collective underachievement, was that nothing's going to change until the ownership changes. And, you know, whatever you might think, if you're a Spurs fan, whatever you might think about the positive things that Levy and Enoch have done for the club in terms of its financial competitiveness, it always comes back, doesn't it? It always comes back to Pochettino's line about how you can have a beautiful house, but you need to fill it with furniture. And we clearly haven't done that in a way that meant we can move from one level to the next. And there are myriad cultural reasons for that within the club. But you at the end of the day, you have to take responsibility and you have to come back to the common denominator, which is the ownership. And I, you know, you and I have talked about this on many occasions at many games, Kev. I didn't used to be Levy out, because there was always plenty of blame to go around when things were going badly. But I think we're at the point now where if we want anything to change in terms of the direction of the club, then it's the ownership that has to change. You know, otherwise we're just condemned to repeat the same mistakes in an almost endless cycle of despair. I apologize for that, but it's true. And I thought it was hilarious when Levy actually did make a statement. He said, "Oh, the buck stops with me. I take responsibility. Christian Stellini will be leaving tomorrow." I mean, that was you couldn't script that again. It was, you know, and to be fair, Stellini did have to go. It just didn't make sense to keep the number two of a manager you've just sacked unless you literally had no other options. But clearly we did. And now the other option is managing the team. Just to put today's game in the context of the second half against Man U. Second half, I thought we were brilliant. And I thought if Mason can use a team talk to get them to play with even a scintilla of pride in themselves and the club, then good on them, because nobody previously has been able to do that. So, you know, that was anyway, there we go. I think it's hard to see today's game, today's disaster, outside of the context of those two previous games. We were given a lesson on against Newcastle. We responded to it against Man U, but then we couldn't build on that. We couldn't build on that second half performance. And today, and even in the second half, when Liverpool, I think, you know, took their foot off the pedal, they thought the game was won at halftime. You just had the sense that we were going to be banging our heads against a brick wall for no outcome, and that's essentially how it ended up. And I was thinking, you know, the last time I was on with you, Kevin, we had our friend from the Anfield Index, and you asked us both how confident we were out of 10. Do you remember about finishing in the top four? Mm. And I said 7 since we'd just beaten Chelsea, and our next run of games looked eminently winnable. And Conte's meltdown at that stage was still just a glint in his eye. I mean, our Anfield Index friend said 4, partly because he thought their start to the season had been so poor that it would have been hard to claw back from. But, you know, it's probably fair to say those assessments can easily and deservedly be reversed tonight.
Hmm. I do think Liverpool are a few too many points shy to meaningfully get into that top four. But yeah, I mean, I totally see what you're saying and how the last 2 months have gone really, really derailed everything. I think you could really toss all of it back to that 1 week when Spurs got knocked out of both the Champions League and the FA Cup. And I was talking to my wife earlier today because for those that don't know, we found out that there's a player committee at Spurs around the time that Stellini was sacked. And apparently, Antonio Conte had told Levy and even some of the players that he wanted to get rid of Dyer, Davis, and Lloris this summer. And wouldn't you know it, that then weeks later when Stellini sacked and we find out not only that a player committee exists, but who's on it, that all three of them are part of it, yeah. Along with Skip and Kane. Yeah. And it really just makes you wonder, when was that comment made? Right. Because if you're told that this might be your last season at a club,
right,
but you're in with a chance of winning a trophy, that's something that you can kind of put on your legacy, you know, get a replica of the trophy, put it on your wall. You finally helped Tottenham break their streak of years without a trophy. Once that's gone, mm-hmm. even if you were fighting for top four, you might not be there to see it.
Right.
So how does that benefit you? Why would that be a thing that you'd commit yourself towards amongst the myriad other issues going on at Spurs? So I am wholly unsurprised that it looks like we don't care, because I think a lot of the players probably just don't at this stage. They've survived so many managers. They understand that in football, it's so hard to move huge amounts of players, although Palace did a pretty good job of it, and then Burnley did last year with the relegation. But yeah, I think there is a level of comfort in understanding that they will probably yet again survive. Whether or not it's those players that survive, time will tell. But yeah, I think we're absolutely seeing not just 11 players, but a squad of players who don't really see the point. And for the players that aren't in the 11, I totally understand. Because this has not been a meritocracy at Spurs this season. It does not matter how well you perform. It does not matter how well you train. The 11 is basically the 11, with the only two switches ever being Longley and Davis, or Kulusevski and Richarlison.
But you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's like playing on a team where you just show up and all your mates basically pick the team. And this is the thing. Somebody said to me the other day, well, do you think Ryan Mason will stay on as manager? And I said, well, you know, he's so close to the current group that he probably couldn't preside over the sort of rebuild that we're going to need. It's going to need somebody to come in from the outside who can actually just look at the, as Conte did, and look at the players and say, okay, we need upgrades in the following positions.
Yeah, it's pretty tough. And a lot of managers have trusted Dyer and Højbjerg to be like leaders at the back. And that hasn't gone particularly well. I think this is one of the worst seasons I've ever seen a center back have, what Eric Dyer is doing this season. But I wanted your thoughts on this. So there are only four teams in the Premier League that have conceded more goals than Tottenham Hotspur this season. Leeds, Bournemouth, Nottingham Forest, Southampton, all famously in the relegation fight. The other teams next to us or just slightly better than us are Leicester and Everton, also in that relegation fight.
Yep.
Dyer's gotten a lot of stick, as has Romero, who's having a pretty down year himself. Yep. Could be the context surrounding him, could be the constant rotation at right back from Emerson to Doherty, who we just randomly released to Porro. The Davis has had his injuries. Longley has been kind of up and down. Perisic has not been the player we thought we were buying. All of that in mind, do you think that our defensive issue... Actually, give me percentages. What percentage of our defensive issues think are due to our actual positioned defenders? And what percentage do you think is down to the midfield, either the ability of the midfield two or the fact that we're always overrun in every match because we're typically playing a midfield two against a midfield three?
Yeah, I don't think it's consistent. I don't think it's... I think what we saw in the Newcastle game and in the first half today is if somebody makes a mistake, there's like a cloud descends on the entire back three, you know, and there's a set. I mean, Davies is probably our most consistent performer in the back three. Dyer, I love Eric Dyer and I have a lot of time for him. And I think part of his problem is nobody could ever figure out what his best position was. Because remember when he made his debut for us and he scored against West Ham, he was playing right back. He was playing right back. And then, you know, he's again, it sort of feeds into this whole kind of why on earth would Pochettino come back to Spurs when most of the players who let him down last time are still here? You know, as I honestly thought he would never come back while Levy was in charge. But there's a bigger thing beyond that. In terms of how we set up and how we organize the defense to the midfield, it's different people's faults in different situations. And I don't think you can actually point to one area and say that's where most of the goals are coming from. I wasn't aware of that stat. That's an appalling stat, actually, that all of those teams who have conceded more than us are in serious. Well, I know Forest and Southampton have a minus 32 goal difference, but, you know, that's just...
I think we've also scored the third most goals this season, but that really hides how many we're conceding.
That's the thing. I mean, I look at goal difference and say, if you have a goal difference that is that bad, like over 30, it doesn't just show you that you have a problem in the defense. You have a problem scoring as well. You have a problem at both ends of the field. And we do not have a problem putting the ball in the net, apart from the fact that our transition is poor. We can't very often get the ball from the midfield to somebody running into the channels, for example. So to your point, I think you can't really point the finger at any particular one particular player. It's a collective, and it's supposed to be a collective. And if somebody makes a mistake, then everything seems to just go downhill from there. And, you know, we talked earlier about the idea that we only start to play once we go behind. It's like it's almost, you know, predictable. It's almost predictable that we can start to turn things around to an extent. It's just it hasn't been enough of an extent in recent games that actually mattered. And I'm not just talking about the three games this week. I'm talking about previous games like Wolves and Southampton as well. You know, so it's just desperately disappointing. The inconsistency is disappointing.
Yep, agreed. I just think it's a mix of all the things. I think you could basically remove any of about 1,000 things that happened to Spurs this season and you'd have a more successful season. But I think the midfield two was a horrendous mistake. I think playing with three defenders is a really big mistake. Because if the goal is to get your best 11 players on the pitch, we've never done that this season. Because you're always deciding to pick your third or fourth best center back over one of your main attacking options. And yeah, just being overrun in midfield as heavily as we have. I mean, the second half against Manchester United, which is probably the best we've actually played in recent memory, Kane became a midfielder, with Son and Richarlison pushing forward, which allowed Kane to actually mark someone in the midfield, which then gave the other two a little bit more freedom. I just think whoever comes in next year has to play either, I guess it doesn't really matter the formation, but you have to be playing a midfield three, whether it be two defensive midfielders and an attacking midfielder, or two box-to-box midfielders and any combination of those things that you want. 4-2-3-1, 4-3-3. Even if you want to go with what Conte won Inter's title with, although I think many Spurs fans are just emotionally done with the back three. But doing a 3-5-2 and still having that midfield three that really helped Eriksen figure out how to track back, which is benefiting Manchester United this year. Anyway, we could talk about...
You hit the nail on the head, absolutely, because we've never replaced Eriksen. And part of the problem is we're actually more potent, potentially more potent, when Harry drops back into that Eriksen role and plays, you know, playing the ball into the channels for Kulusevski and Son. That's why if Harry goes, Maddison would be a good addition, I think, because he can play in that drop deep midfield role.
Yep.
So, but we'll see. Well, I mean, that's a conversation for a whole other day.
It truly is. All right. Well, we'll wrap up here with match previews, or in this case, match preview, since it's Tottenham versus Crystal Palace. Sam, I gotta imagine you're feeling pretty confident after about 20 minutes we just spent ranting about Spurs. But what are you thinking heading into this one?
Yeah, you'd think that I'd be confident until you look at our record against Spurs. I feel like Spurs always come into this fixture on a terrible run of form and then end up like trouncing us 4-0 or something. I think that the very same thing happened earlier this season when I think you guys were on some sort of run where you hadn't scored the first goal in a game for like 11 matches, and then Kane was just unplayable that night. You guys basically gave us the runaround, and it was 4-0. And I think our record at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium and even White Hart Lane before that is really, really bad. I think we've maybe scored like once at the new stadium. Not that we've played there that many times, but still not the best record. So, on paper, and I hate using the phrase on paper, a lot of people would probably be looking at this Palace having won a number of their recent, having only lost one game under Hodgson, and Spurs being in the state they are at the moment, a lot of people will be thinking that Palace will go there and win it. But I've been watching Palace for far too many years to think that that's going to happen. I think every single Palace fan will probably be thinking the same, and saw a few tweets today saying something along the lines of, I'd like to congratulate Spurs on their return to form next week. There's no reason for Palace not to go and win the game. Like, we are in great form, our team's fit, everyone's pretty confident, we're playing some exciting stuff, and you'd sort of think that we'd have the players to kind of take advantage of some of that fragility that Spurs seem to have at the back at the moment. Fingers crossed it's a good day for us. But I've seen this script all too many times before, so there's no part of me that wants to say we're going to win the game.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it'll pretty much the same. I mean, I actually thought, to be honest, because I just got back from the US, and I thought that because of the coronation, the premiership program was going to be postponed. And I texted Kevin, and I have a Palace supporting friend, Johnny Hopkins, and I texted him saying, "Hey mate, we play you next week, is the Premiership program postponed because of the coronation?" He says, no, you'll get back on track next week." And I said, no, I don't think so. Don't think so somehow. But I think, you know, Roy has created a sense of self-belief about Palace that I think, as Sam said, it's as simple as playing your best players in their best positions. And you know, Ryan Mason could probably learn a bit from that. But games like this at this stage of the season do come down very much to momentum and confidence. And Palace have it at the moment. We clearly don't, given what happened over the past three games. But if we could recapture some of the way we played against Man United in the second half, then who knows? I don't want to predict. I mean, I would feel a little less confident if we were going to Selhurst rather than rather than having it at home. But I don't want to predict it at this stage.
Gotcha. And Sam, I totally understand your hesitation. Because Eriksen used to always score the winner against you, and then he left, and now it's Son every time. So obviously not feeling comfortable. But it's worth noting, Tottenham have won one match in their last seven. And here's the fun part. I was there for it. I got to see the Brighton match where they were robbed of about seven goals, and Sonny scored his 100th. And what a fun reprieve that was in the middle of this absolute horror show.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? There's always the potential for that to happen. There's always, like, Spurs just have enough good players for, like, one day it just to go right. And
right.
It usually tends to happen against Crystal Palace. It's like, we are just that team we are that one in those stats. Like, it's like Frank Lampard's one win in his last 20 Premier League games was against Crystal Palace. It was like two of Graham Potter's six wins as Chelsea managers were against Crystal Palace. It's just, we are that stat. We are always that stat. So, yeah, forgive me for not being overly confident.
I don't think we've concentrated enough on just how much disarray Chelsea are in at the moment. I mean, it's even worse than ours. But then the worst thing is the fact that Pochettino's about to go there is because he sees that as a potentially better project than us.
Well, we never called him, so who knows what he thinks about us in comparison to them. But that's a failure on a whole different level that I'm sure we'll talk about on a future episode of the EPL Roundtable. But thanks to you two so much for coming on today. If you want to tell the folks where they can find you or anything you're working on, now would be a great time.
Yeah, cheers, Kev. Thanks, Steve. Really enjoyed that. I've been Sam Karp. You can find me on Sam_Karp. If you want to read some occasional articles I write about Palace, you can find that on the Eagles Beak. And if you want to read some stuff I write about the sports industry at large, you can find that on the Sports Pro website.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. Thank you, Kevin, for having me back again. You can get me on Twitter at Steve McGookin. And if you want to read my other stuff, which is I read a blog about baseball and American society, you can get that at statesofplayproject.com.
Yeah, and I'm your host, Kevin DeVries. You can find me on Twitter at Kevroff. You can find the show at EPL Roundtable on Twitter and in all of your podcast services. But yeah, thanks again to these two for coming on. And folks at home, we hope you keep listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.